with arguing for the truth of religion, the problems for arguing for its utility. The last way to defend God is to essentially attack atheism as another religion. It's intolerant, it's dogmatic, it's arrogant. All right, let's get this straight. Jews, Christians, and Muslims claim that their holy books are so profound, so prescient of humanity's needs, that they could only have been written under the direction of an omniscient deity. An atheist is simply someone who has considered this claim, read the books, and found the claim to be ridiculous. There is nothing that needs to be presupposed on insufficient evidence in order to reject the biblical God. I mean, what dogma have we all embraced to not take Zeus and Poseidon and Apollo into account on a daily basis? What dogma have we used to reject all of the thousands of dead gods who now lie buried in that mass grave we call mythology? What would it be dogmatic to doubt that the Iliad or the Odyssey was written by the creator of the universe? This is not dogmatism. As Carl Sagan said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. That is all you need for atheism. I mean, that if ever there were an antidote to dogmatism, that's it. There's a related claim, the idea that atheism is arrogant, and science generally is arrogant in its dismissal of religion. This is really ironic. This claim reverberates ceaselessly in the echo chamber of American religious discourse, but it is a profound irony to see religious people praising themselves for their humility while essentially making claims about cosmology and physics and astronomy and geology and biology and paleontology and just dozens of specific sciences that no scientist could make. I mean, every religious person who takes the Genesis account of creation, say, seriously, 53% of Americans seemingly take it literally, but just even dignifying it as informative. Any person who's doing this is essentially saying to somebody like Stephen Hawking, Stephen, you're a smart guy. I see you got a lot of equations over there, but you essentially don't know enough about cosmology, because here, God did this in 6 days and then he rested on the seventh, and it could be a metaphor, but I don't see you really grappling with the nuances here. And they're essentially saying to someone like Richard Dawkins or Robert Trivers or any evolutionary biologist, they're saying, you're saying all this stuff about DNA and the fossil record and radiocarbon dating, but it says here that man was made in a separate act of creation, and we should ponder over that. And this would be amusing, this kind of covert arrogance, if it were not having such a disastrous effect. If it were not impeding the teaching of science in this country. 30% of biology teachers don't even mention evolution because it is such a hassle to deal with the religious lunacy of their students and their parents. If this really is impeding medical research, it really is eroding the prestige of the United States in the eyes of the rest of the world. You saw this recent Republican debate. When asked, how many of you reject evolution? 3 arms go up. I mean, this is flabbergasting. These people are seeking the highest office, not only the highest office in the land, they're seeking more power and responsibility than any person has had in human history. So to wrap up, let me just say that none of what I've just said should be construed as a denial of the importance of ethics in our lives, or even the importance of spiritual experience. You can be someone who's deeply committed to transforming your moment-to-moment perception of the world and use techniques like meditation and fasting. And I mean, you can go into a cave for a year and be a mystic if you want to. None of that requires presupposing anything on insufficient evidence. And none of that requires that we lie to ourselves or to our children about our state of knowledge about the world. And the problem I have with religion, both at every point on the spectrum, from moderate to extreme, is that it stands as a permanent denial of the possibility of developing a truly rational, modern, open-ended discussion about the nature of our subjectivity, about the possibility of ethics and spirituality truly in conformity with our rationality as it exists now. Every religious person, every person who's committed to still being a Christian or a Jew or a Buddhist is essentially giving tacit endorsement to the religious divisions in our world and essentially saying that we need some measure of mythology, we need some measure of fairy tale, we need to pretend on some occasions that we know things we do not know. And it's simply untrue. So I think that's probably enough to get us started. Thank you.
Chris is going to use the podium.
I have notes, so yeah. It's easier. Before I begin my critique of Sam and his book, I want to say that we do share one, very important belief, and that is that both of us feel that it's time to stop tolerating the intolerant, and that societies that tolerate the intolerant... That eventually both the tolerant disappear and tolerance along with them. And so I do laud Sam for his courage. And as you heard that Bob said, I just wrote a book on the Christian right called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America. So on that, you know, I laud Sam for standing up. But I don't... I come from a religious background. I guess in some vague way I still consider myself religious. And I think Sam... in my mind, has conflated faith, which I hold of some importance, with tribalism. I think his book is an attack not so much on faith, but on a system of being and believing that is dangerous and is compatible with the open society. But what he attacks is superstition, a belief in magic, the childish notion of an anthropomorphic god that is characteristic of the tribe, of the closed society. And he calls this religion, and I do not. I think what Sam, in my mind, fails to grasp is not simply the meaning of faith, something that I'll address a little later on, but the supreme importance of the monotheistic traditions in creating the concept of the individual. This individualism, the belief that we can exist as distinct beings from the tribe or the crowd, and that we are called on as individuals to make moral decisions that at times defy the clamor of the tribe or the nation, is a gift of the Abrahamic faiths. This sense of individual responsibility is coupled with the constant injunctions in Islam, Judaism, and Christianity for a deep altruism, and this laid the foundations for the open society. This individualism is the central doctrine and most important contribution of monotheism. We are enjoined, after all, to love our neighbor, not our tribe. This empowerment of individual conscience is the starting point of the great ethical systems of our civilization. The prophets, and here I would include Jesus, helped institutionalize dissent and criticism. They initiated the separation of powers. They reminded us that that culture and society was not the sole prerogative of the powerful, that freedom, and indeed the religious life, required us to often oppose and defy those in authority. This is a distinctly anti-tribal outlook. They ossify the message. And once ossified, it can never reach an existential level, never rise to ethical freedom, to faith. The more vast the gap between professed faith and acts of faith, the more vast our delusions about our own grandeur and importance, the more intolerant, aggressive, and dangerous we become. Faith is not in conflict with reason. Faith does not conflict with scientific truth unless faith claims to express a scientific truth. Faith can neither be affirmed nor denied by scientific, historical, or philosophical truth. And here I think Sam confuses the irrational, which he sees as part of faith, with the non-rational. There is a reality that is not a product of rational deduction. It is not accounted for by strict rational discourse. There is a spiritual dimension to human existence and the universe, but this is not irrational. It is non-rational. Faith allows us to transcend what Flaubert says was our mania for conclusions, a mania he described as one of humanity's most useless and sterile drives. Reason allows us to worship at the idol of our own intrinsic moral superiority. And it can be a dangerous form of idolatry, a form of faith, certainly, but one the biblical writers knew led to evil and eventually self-immolation. We are at war with Islam, Sam writes in The End of Faith. It may not serve our immediate foreign policy objectives for our political leaders to openly acknowledge this fact, but it is unambiguously so. It is not merely that we are at war with an otherwise peaceful religion that has been hijacked by extremists. We are at war with precisely the vision of life that is prescribed to all Muslims in the Quran and further elaborated in the literature of the Hadith, which recounts the sayings and teachings of the Prophet. Sam assures us that the Quran mandates such hatred, that the problem is with Islam itself. He writes that Islam, more than any other religion human beings have devised, has all the makings of a thoroughgoing cult of death. Now, after studying 600 hours of Arabic, spending 7 years of my life in the Middle East, most of them as the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times, I do not claim to be a scholar on Islam. But I know the Quran is emphatic about the rights of other religions to practice their own beliefs and unequivocally condemns attacks on civilians as a violation of Islam. The Quran states that suicide of any type is an abomination. More importantly, the tactic of suicide bombing was pioneered as a weapon of choice by the Tamils, who are chiefly Hindu, in Sri Lanka, long before it was adopted by Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, or Hamas. It is what you do when you do not have artillery or planes or missiles and you want to create maximum terror. I also know from my time in the Muslim world that the vast majority of the some 1 billion Muslims on the planet, most of whom are not Arab, are moderate. Detest the violence done in the name of their religion, and look at Pat Robertson or Franklin Graham, who demonize Muslims in the name of Christianity with the same horror and fear that we look at Osama bin Laden or the leaders of Hamas. The Palestinian resistance movement only took on radical Islam coloring in the 1990s, when conditions in Gaza and the West Bank deteriorated and thrust people into profound helplessness, despair, and poverty, similar conditions that are empowering the Christian right in our own country. Before that, the movement was decidedly secular. I know that Muslim societies are shaped far more by national characteristics, and Iraqi has a culture and outlook on life that is quite different from an Indonesian, just as a French citizen, although a Catholic, is influenced far more by the conditions of his culture or her culture. Islam does have within it tiny, marginal groups that worship death, but nearly all suicide bombers come from one language group within the Muslim world, Arabic, which represents only 20% of Muslims. And I have seen the bodies, including the bodies of children, left in the wake of a suicide bombing attack in Jerusalem, and I have seen the frail, thin bodies of boys shot to death for sport by Israeli soldiers in the Gaza Strip. Tell me the moral difference. I fail to see one, especially as a father. Finally, let us not forget that the worst genocides and slaughters of the last century were not perpetrated by Muslims, but by Christians. His demonization of the Muslim world, for someone who lived in Sarajevo during the Serbian siege of the city, is odd. It was the Muslim-led government in Bosnia that practiced tolerance. There were some 10,000 Serbs who remained in the city and fought alongside the Bosnian Muslims during the war. The city's Jewish community, dating back to 1492, was also loyal to the Sarajevo government. And the worst atrocities of that war were blessed not by imams, but Catholic and Serbian Orthodox priests. His argument that atheists have a higher moral code is as specious as his attacks on Islam. Does he forget Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, and Pol Pot? These three alone have filled the earth with more corpses in the last century than all of the world's clerics combined. The danger is not Islam or Christianity or any other religion. It is the human heart, the capacity we all have for evil. All human institutions with a lust for power give their utopian visions divine sanction. Whether this comes through the worship of God, destiny, historical inevitability, the master race, a worker's paradise, fraternite, egalite, liberte, or the second coming of Jesus Christ. Religion is often a convenient vehicle for this bloodlust. Religious institutions often sanctify genocide, but this says more about us, about the nature of human institutions and the darkest yearnings of the human heart than it does about religion. Sam, I believe, externalizes evil, and when you externalize evil, all tools, including violence and torture, become legitimate to eradicate that evil, an evil that is always outside of you. This worldview, one that is also adopted by the Christian right, is dangerous. For if we fail to acknowledge our own capacity for evil, it will grow unchecked and unheeded. It is, in essence, the call to live the unexamined life. The externalization of evil is used in Sam's book to endorse torture. He, of course, argues that the reason that requires us to waterboard detainees and the physical and moral black holes we have set up to make them disappear comes from the threat of terrorism. He quotes Alan Dershowitz not only to reassure us that the Israelis treat Palestinians, 400 of whom have been killed in Gaza over the past few months, humanely, but to trot out this notion of a ticking time bomb, the idea that we know a terrorist has planted a large bomb in the center of a city and we must torture him, or in the glib phrase from Sam's book, we must dust off a strappado and expose this unpleasant fellow to a season of bygone times. This reference to torture might be amusing if you have spent your life encased in the protective world of the university. But as someone who was captured and held for a week by Iraqi Republican Guard during the 1991 Shiite uprising in Basra, and then turned over for my final 24 hours to the Iraqi secret police, whom my captors openly expected to execute me, I find this glib talk of physical abuse difficult. Dershowitz and Harris cannot give us a legal or historical precedent where such a case as they describe actually happened. But this is not the point. The point is to endow us as a nation with a moral right to abuse others in the name of a particular version of goodness. This is done in the name of reason. It is done in the name of a false god and idol. And this god, if you want it named, is the god of death. Or as Freud stated, thanatos, the death instinct, the impulse that works towards the annihilation of all living things, including ourselves. For once you torture, even in the name of reason, even in the name of security, you unleash sadists and killers. You consign human beings to moral oblivion. You become no better than those you oppose. The danger of this worldview is that it does what these fundamentalists do. It creates the illusion of a binary world of us and them, of reason versus irrationality, of the forces of light battling the forces of darkness. And once you set up this world, you are permitted to view military intervention, brutal occupation and torture, anything, in short, that will subdue this evil, these forces that you define as irrational and dangerous, is justified. All of this is done in the name of reason, in the name of this God, which looks like all idols, an awful lot like the people who expound it. Necessity, William Pitt wrote, is the plea for every infringement of human reason. Sam ends his book with a chapter that can best be described as Buddhism light. His spirituality, which apparently includes belief in life after death and telepathy, fuels, I think, our narcissistic obsession with our individual unconscious. I'm not against solitude or meditation, but only when it feeds the moral life rather than is used as an excuse to avoid moral commitment. The quest for personal fulfillment can become an excuse for the individual to negate his or her responsibilities as a citizen, as a member of a wider community. And this religion is in tune with the narcissism that sweeps through our culture. This idealized version of Buddhism is part, I think, of Sam's inability to see that it too has been used to feed the lusts of warriors and killers. It too has been hijacked in the name of radical evil. Buddhist Shinto warrior cults justified and absolved those who carried out the worst atrocities committed by the Japanese in Nanjing. By the end of World War II, Buddhist and Shinto priests recruited and indoctrinated kamikaze pilots in the name of another god. It is an old story. It is not the evil of religion, but the inherent capacity for evil in the human heart. The point of religion, authentic religion... Yeah, I'm almost done. Last page. The point of religion, authentic religion, is not that in the end it is about us. It is about the other, about the stranger lying beaten and robbed on the side of the road, about the poor, the outcasts, the marginalized, the sick, the destitute, about those who are being abused and beaten in cells in Guantanamo and a host of other secret locations, about what we as a society do to gays and lesbians, what we do to the 47 million Americans without health insurance, the illegal immigrants who live among us without rights or protection. Their suffering is as invisible as the suffering of the mentally ill we have relegated to heating grates or prison cells. It is about them. We have forgotten who we were meant to be, who we were created to be, because we have forgotten that we find God not in ourselves, finally, but in our care for our neighbor, in the stranger, including those outside the nation and the faith. The religious life is not designed to make you happy or safe or content. It is not designed to make you whole or complete, to free you from anxieties and fear. It is designed to save you from yourself, to make possible human community, to understand that the greatest force in life is not power or reason, but love. As Niebuhr wrote, "Nothing worth doing is completed in our lifetime. Therefore, we are saved by hope. Nothing true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we are saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we are saved by love. No virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as from our own. Therefore, we are saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness." Thank you.